calls. The winner advances. The winner of this tournament will be that single player who has won N consecutive coin tosses without a loss, depending on how many rounds it takes to complete the tournament. There is something strange and trivial about this tournament. But what is it? The winner does have a rather remarkable property. How often have you ever met anyone who just won, say, 10 consecutive coin tosses without a loss? Probably never. The odds against there being such a person might seem enormous, and in the normal course of events, they surely are. If some gambler offered you 10-to-1 odds that he could produce someone who, before your very eyes, would proceed to win 10 consecutive coin tosses using a fair coin, you might be inclined to think this is a good bet. If so, you had better hope the gambler doesn't have 1,024 accomplices. They don't have to cheat. They play fair and square. For that is all it takes. 2 to the 10th power competitors to form a 10-round tournament. The gambler wouldn't have a clue, as the tournament started, which person would end up being the exhibit A that would guarantee his winning the wager. But the tournament algorithm is sure to produce such a person in short order. It is a sucker bet with a surefire win for the gambler. I am not responsible for any injuries you may sustain if you attempt to get rich by putting this tidbit of practical philosophy into use. Any elimination tournament produces a winner, who automatically has whatever property was required to advance through the rounds, but, as the coin-tossing tournament demonstrates, the property in question may be merely historical. A trivial fact about the competitor's past history that has no bearing at all on his or her future prospects. Suppose, for instance, the United Nations were to decide that all future international conflicts would be settled by a coin toss, to which each nation sends a representative. If more than one nation is involved, it will have to be some sort of tournament. It might be a round robin, which is a different algorithm. Whom should we designate as our national representative? The best coin toss caller in the land, obviously. Suppose we organized every man, woman, and child in the USA into a giant elimination tournament. Somebody would have to win, and that person would have just won 28 consecutive coin tosses without a loss. This would be an irrefutable historical fact about that person, but since calling a coin toss is just a matter of luck, there is absolutely no reason to believe that the winner of such a tournament would do any better in international competition than somebody else who lost in an earlier round of the tournament. Chance has no memory. A person who holds the winning lottery ticket has certainly been lucky, and thanks to the millions she has just won, she may never need to be lucky again. Which is just as well, since there is no reason to think she is more likely than anyone else to win the lottery a second time, or to win the next coin toss she calls. Failing to appreciate the fact that chance has no memory is known as the gambler's fallacy. It is surprisingly popular. So popular that I should probably stress that it is a fallacy, beyond any doubt or controversy. In contrast to tournaments of pure luck, like the coin toss tournament, there are tournaments of skill, like tennis tournaments. Here, there is reason to believe that the players in the later rounds would do better again if they played the players who lost in the early rounds. There is reason to believe, but no guarantee, that the winner of such a tournament is the best player of them all, not just today, but tomorrow. Yet, though any well-run tournament is guaranteed to produce a winner, there is no guarantee that a tournament of skill will identify the best player as the winner in any non-trivial sense. That's why we sometimes say in the opening ceremonies, "May the best man win," because it is not guaranteed by the procedure. The best player, the one who is best by engineering standards, has the most reliable backhand, fastest serve, most stamina, etc., may have an off day, or sprain his ankle, or get hit by lightning. Then, trivially, he may be bested in competition by a player who is not really as good as he is. but nobody would bother organizing or entering tournaments of skill if it weren't the case that, in the long run, tournaments of skill are won by the best players. That is guaranteed by the very definition of a fair tournament of skill. If there were no probability greater than half that the better players would win each round, it would be a tournament of luck, not of skill. Skill and luck intermingle naturally and inevitably in any real competition, but their ratios may vary widely. A tennis tournament played on very bumpy courts would raise the luck ratio, as would an innovation in which the players were required to play Russian roulette with a loaded revolver before continuing after the first set. But even in such a luck-ridden contest, more of the better players would tend, statistically, to get to the late rounds. The power of a tournament to discriminate skill differences in the long run may be diminished by haphazard catastrophe, but it is not, in general, reduced to zero. This fact, which is as true of evolutionary algorithms in nature as of elimination tournaments in sports, is sometimes overlooked by commentators on evolution. Skill, in contrast to luck, is projectable. In the same or similar circumstances, it can be counted on to give repeat performances. This relativity to circumstances shows us another way in which a tournament might be weird. What if the conditions of competition kept changing, like the croquet game in Alice in Wonderland? If you play tennis the first round, chess in the second round, golf in the third round, and billiards in the fourth round, there is no reason to suppose the eventual winner will be particularly good, compared with the whole field, in any of these endeavors. All the good golfers may lose in the chess round and never get a chance to demonstrate their prowess. And even if luck plays no role in the fourth round billiards final, the winner might turn out to be the second worst billiards player in the whole field. Thus, there has to be some measure of uniformity of the conditions of competition for there to be any interesting outcome to a tournament. But does a tournament, or any algorithm, have to do something interesting? No. The algorithms we tend to talk about almost always do something interesting. That's why they attract our attention. But a procedure doesn't fail to be an algorithm just because it is of no conceivable use or value to anyone. Consider a variation on the elimination tournament algorithm, in which the losers of the semifinals play in the finals. This is a stupid rule, destroying the point of the whole tournament. But the tournament would still be an algorithm. Algorithms don't have to have points or purposes. In addition to all the useful algorithms for alphabetizing lists of words, there are gazillions of algorithms for reliably misalphabetizing words, and they work perfectly every time, as if anyone would care, just as there is an algorithm, many actually, for finding the square root of any number. So there are algorithms for finding the square root of any number except 18 or 703. Some algorithms do things so boringly irregular and pointless that there is no succinct way of saying what they are for. They just do what they do, and they do it every time. We can now expose perhaps the most common misunderstanding of Darwinism. The idea that Darwin showed that evolution by natural selection is a procedure for producing us. Ever since Darwin proposed his theory, people have often misguidedly tried to interpret it as showing that we are the destination, the goal, the point of all that winnowing and competition, and our arrival on the scene was guaranteed by the mere holding of the tournament. This confusion has been fostered by evolution's friends and foes alike, and it is parallel to the confusion of the coin toss tournament winner, who basks in the misconsidered glory of the idea that since the tournament had to have a winner, and since he is the winner, the tournament had to produce him as the winner. Evolution can be an algorithm, and evolution can have produced us by an algorithmic process, without it being true that evolution is an algorithm for producing us. The main conclusion of Stephen Jay Gould's Wonderful Life, the Burgess Shale and the Nature of History, 1989A, is that if we were to wind the tape of life back and play it again and again, the likelihood is infinitesimal of us being the product on any other run through the evolutionary mill. This is undoubtedly true if by us we mean the particular variety of Homo sapiens we are, hairless and upright, with five fingers on each of two hands, speaking English and French and playing tennis and chess. Evolution is not a process that was designed to produce us. But it does not follow from this that evolution is not an algorithmic process that has, in fact, produced us. Chapter 10 will explore this issue in more detail. Evolutionary algorithms are manifestly interesting algorithms, interesting to us at least, not because what they are guaranteed to do is interesting to us, but because what they are guaranteed to tend to do is interesting to us. They are like tournaments of skill in this regard. The power of an algorithm to yield something of interest or value is not at all limited to what the algorithm can be mathematically proven to yield in a foolproof way. And this is especially true of evolutionary algorithms. Most of the controversies about Darwinism, as we shall hear, boil down to disagreements about just how powerful certain postulated evolutionary processes are. Could they actually do all this or all that in the time available? These are typically investigations into what an evolutionary algorithm might produce or could produce or is likely to produce, and only indirectly into what such an algorithm would inevitably produce. Darwin himself sets the stage in the wording of his summary. His idea is a claim about what assuredly the process of natural selection will tend to yield. All algorithms are guaranteed to do whatever they do, but it need not be anything interesting. Some algorithms are further guaranteed to tend, with probability P, to do something which may or may not be interesting. But if what an algorithm is guaranteed to do doesn't have to be interesting in any way, how are we going to distinguish algorithms from other processes? Won't any process be an algorithm? Is the surf pounding on the beach an algorithmic process? Is the sun baking the clay of a dried-up riverbed an algorithmic process? The answer is that there may be features of these processes that are best appreciated if we consider them as algorithms. Consider, for instance, the question of why the grains of sand on a beach are so uniform in size. This is due to a natural sorting process that occurs thanks to the repetitive launching of the grains by the surf. Alphabetical order on a grand scale, you might say. The pattern of cracks that appear in the sun-baked clay may be best explained by looking at chains of events that are not unlike the successive rounds in a tournament. Or consider the process of annealing a piece of metal to temper it. What could be a more physical, less computational process than that? The blacksmith repeatedly heats the metal and then lets it cool, and somehow in the process it becomes much stronger. How? What kind of an explanation can we give for this magical transformation? Does the heat create special toughness atoms that coat the surface? Or does it suck subatomic glue out of the atmosphere that binds all the iron atoms together? No, nothing like that happens. The right level of explanation is the algorithmic level. As the metal cools from its molten state, the solidification starts in many different spots at the same time, creating crystals that grow together until the whole is solid. But the first time this happens, the arrangement of the individual crystal structures is suboptimal, weakly held together, and with lots of internal stresses and strains. Heating it up again, but not all the way to melting, partially breaks down these structures so that, when they are permitted to cool the next time, the broken-up bits will adhere to the still solid bits in a different arrangement. It can be proven mathematically that these rearrangements will tend to get better and better, approaching the optimum or strongest total structure, provided the regime of heating and cooling has the right parameters. So powerful is this optimization procedure that it has been used as the inspiration for an entirely general problem-solving technique in computer science, simulated annealing, which has nothing to do with metals or heat, but is just a way of getting a computer program to build, disassemble, and rebuild a data structure, such as another program, over and over, blindly groping towards a better, indeed an optimal version. Kirkpatrick, Gillatt, and Vecchi, 1983. This was one of the major insights leading to the development of Boltzmann machines and Hopfield nets, and the other constraint satisfaction schemes that are the basis for the connectionist or neural net architectures in artificial intelligence. For overviews, see Smolensky, 1983, Rumelhart, 1989, Churchland, and Sejnowski, 1992, and on a philosophical level, Dennett, 1987a, Paul Churchland, 1989, in the downloadable PDF. If you want a deep understanding of how annealing works in metallurgy, you have to learn the physics of all the forces operating at the atomic level, of course. But notice that the basic idea of how annealing works, and particularly why it works, can be lifted clear of those details. After all, I just explained it in simple lay terms, and I don't know the physics. The explanation of annealing can be put in substrate-neutral terminology. We should expect optimization of a certain sort to occur in any material that has components that get put together by a certain sort of building process and that can be disassembled in a sequenced way by changing a single global parameter, etc. That is what is common to the processes going on in the glowing steel bar and the humming supercomputer. Darwin's ideas about the powers of natural selection can also be lifted out of their home base in biology. Indeed, as we have already noted, Darwin himself had few inklings, and what inklings he had turned out to be wrong, about how the microscopic processes of genetic inheritance were accomplished. Not knowing any of the details about the physical substrate, he could nevertheless discern that if certain conditions were somehow met, certain effects would be wrought. This substrate neutrality has been crucial in permitting the basic Darwinian insights to float like a cork on the waves of subsequent research and controversy. For what has happened since Darwin has a curious flip-flop in it. Darwin, as we noted in the preceding chapter, never hit upon the utterly necessary idea of a gene. But along came Mendel's concept to provide just the right structure for making mathematical sense out of heredity and solving Darwin's nasty problem of blending inheritance. And then, when DNA was identified as the actual physical vehicle of the genes, it looked at first, and still looks to many participants, as if Mendel's genes could be simply identified as particular hunks of DNA. But then complexities began to emerge. The more scientists have learned about the actual molecular biology of DNA and its role in reproduction, the clearer it becomes that the Mendelian story is at best a vast oversimplification. Some would go so far as to say that we have recently learned that there really aren't any Mendelian genes. Having climbed Mendel's ladder, we must now throw it away. But of course, no one wants to throw away such a valuable tool, still proving itself daily in hundreds of scientific and medical contexts. The solution is to bump Mendel up a level and declare that he, like Darwin, captured an abstract truth about inheritance. We may, if we like, talk of virtual genes, considering them to have their reality distributed around in the concrete materials of the DNA. There is much to be said in favor of this option, which I will discuss further in chapters 5 and 12. But then, to return to the question raised previously, are there any limits at all on what may be considered an algorithmic process? I guess the answer is no. If you wanted to, you could treat any process at the abstract level as an algorithmic process. So what? Only some processes yield interesting results when you do treat them as algorithms. But we don't have to try to define algorithm in such a way as to include only the interesting ones. A tall philosophical order. The problem will take care of itself, since nobody will waste time examining the algorithms that aren't interesting for one reason or another. It all depends on what needs explaining. If what strikes you as puzzling is the uniformity of the sand grains or the strength of the blade, an algorithmic explanation is what will satisfy your curiosity. And it will be the truth. Other interesting features of the same phenomena, or the processes that created them, might not yield to an algorithmic treatment. Here, then, is Darwin's dangerous idea. The algorithmic level is the level that best accounts for the speed of the antelope, the wing of the eagle, the shape of the orchid, the diversity of species, and all the other occasions for wonder in the world of nature. It is hard to believe that something as mindless and mechanical as an algorithm could produce such wonderful things. No matter how impressive the products of an algorithm, the underlying process always consists of nothing but a set of individually mindless steps succeeding each other without the help of any intelligent supervision. They are automatic by definition, the workings of an automaton. They feed on each other or on blind chance, coin flips if you like, and on nothing else. Most algorithms we are familiar with have rather modest products. They do long division or alphabetize lists or figure out the income of the average taxpayer. Fancier algorithms produce the dazzling computer animated graphics we see every day on television, transforming faces, creating herds of imaginary ice-skating polar bears, simulating whole virtual worlds of entities never seen or imagined before. But the actual biosphere is much fancier still, by many orders of magnitude. Can it really be the outcome of nothing but a cascade of algorithmic processes feeding on chance? And if so, who designed that cascade? Nobody. It is itself the product of a blind algorithmic process. As Darwin himself put it in a letter to the geologist Charles Lyell shortly after publication of Origin, "I would give absolutely nothing for the theory of natural selection if it requires miraculous additions at any one stage of descent. If I were convinced that I required such additions to the theory of natural selection, I would reject it as rubbish." F. Darwin, 1911, Volume 2, pages 6 and 7. According to Darwin, then, evolution is an algorithmic process. Putting it this way is still controversial. One of the tugs of war going on within evolutionary biology is between those who are relentlessly pushing towards an algorithmic treatment, and those who, for various submerged reasons, are resisting this trend. It is rather as if there were metallurgists around who were disappointed by the algorithmic explanation of annealing. "You mean that's all there is to it? No submicroscopic superglue specially created by the heating and cooling process?" Darwin has convinced all the scientists that evolution, like annealing, works. His radical vision of how and why it works is still somewhat embattled, largely because those who resist can dimly see that their skirmish is part of a larger campaign. If the game is lost in evolutionary biology, where will it all end? Chapter 2, Darwin conclusively demonstrated that, contrary to ancient tradition, species are not eternal and immutable. They evolve. The origin of new species was shown to be the result of descent with modification. Less conclusively, Darwin introduced an idea of how this evolutionary process took place via a mindless, mechanical, algorithmic process he called natural selection. This idea that all the fruits of evolution can be explained as the products of an algorithmic process is Darwin's dangerous idea. Chapter 3, many people, Darwin included, could dimly see that his idea of natural selection had revolutionary potential. But just what did it promise to overthrow? Darwin's idea can be used to dismantle and then rebuild a traditional structure of Western thought, which I call the cosmic pyramid. This provides a new explanation of the origin by gradual accumulation of all the design in the universe. Ever since Darwin, skepticism has been aimed at his implicit claim that the various processes of natural selection, in spite of their underlying mindlessness, are powerful enough to have done all the design work that is manifest in the world. Chapter 3. Universal Acid. 1. Early Reactions. Origin of man now proved. Metaphysics must flourish. He who understands baboon would do more towards metaphysics than Locke. Charles Darwin, in a notebook not intended for publication in P.H. Barrett, et al., 198, D26, M84. His subject is the origin of species, and not the origin of organization, and it seems a needless mischief to have opened the latter speculation at all. Harriet Martineau, a friend of Darwin's, in a letter to Fanny Wedgwood, March 13, 1860, quoted in Desmond and Moore, 1991, page 486. Darwin began his explanation in the middle, or even, you might say, at the end, starting with the life forms we presently see and showing how the patterns in today's biosphere could be explained as having arisen by the process of natural selection from the patterns in yesterday's biosphere and so on, back into the very distant past. He started with facts that everyone knows. All of today's living things are the offspring of parents, who are the offspring of grandparents and so forth, so everything that is alive today is a branch of a genealogical family, which is itself a branch of a larger clan. He went on to argue that if you go back far enough, you find that all the branches of all the families eventually spring from common ancestral limbs, so that there is a single tree of life, all the limbs, branches, and twigs united by descent with modification. The fact that it has the branching organization of a tree is crucial to the explanation of the sort of process involved. For such a tree could be created by an automatic, recursive process. First, build an X, then modify X's descendants, then modify those modifications, then modify the modifications of the modifications. If life is a tree, it could all have arisen from an inexorable, automatic rebuilding process in which designs would accumulate over time. Working backwards, starting at or near the end of a process, then solving the next-to-last step before asking how it could have been produced, is a tried-and-true method of computer programmers, particularly when creating programs that use recursion. Usually, this is a matter of practical modesty. If you don't want to bite off more than you can chew, the right bite to start with is often the finishing bite, if you can find it. Darwin found it, and then very cautiously worked his way back, skirting around the many grand issues that his investigation stirred up, musing about them in his private notebooks, but postponing their publication indefinitely. For instance, he deliberately avoided discussing human evolution and origin. See the discussion in R.J. Richards, 1987, pages 160 and the pages that follow, available in the downloadable PDF. But he could see where all this was leading, And, in spite of his near-perfect silence on these troubling extrapolations, so could many of his readers. Some loved what they thought they saw, and others hated it. Karl Marx was exultant. Not only is a death blow dealt here for the first time to teleology in the natural sciences, but their rational meaning is empirically explained, quoted in Rachel's 1991, page 110. Friedrich Nietzsche saw, through the mists of his contempt for all things English, an even more cosmic message in Darwin: God is dead. If Nietzsche is the father of existentialism, then perhaps Darwin deserves the title of grandfather. Others were less enthralled with the thought that Darwin's views were utterly subversive to sacred tradition. Samuel Wilberforce, Bishop of Oxford, whose debate with Thomas Huxley in June 1860 was one of the most celebrated confrontations between Darwinism and the religious establishment, listen to chapter 12, said in an anonymous review, "Man's derived supremacy over the earth, man's power of articulate speech, man's gift of reason, man's free will and responsibility, all are equally and utterly irreconcilable with the degrading notion of the brute origin of him who was created in the image of God." Wilberforce, 1860. When speculation on these extensions of his view arose, Darwin wisely chose to retreat to the security of his base camp, the magnificently provisioned and defended thesis that began in the middle, with life already on the scene, and merely showed how, once this process of design accumulation was underway, it could proceed without any further intervention from any mind. But as many of his readers appreciated, however comforting this modest disclaimer might be, it was not really a stable resting place. Did you ever hear of universal acid? This fantasy used to amuse me and some of my schoolboy friends. I have no idea whether we invented or inherited it, along with Spanish fly and saltpeter, as a part of underground youth culture. Universal acid is a liquid so corrosive that it will eat through anything. The problem is, what do you keep it in? It dissolves glass bottles and stainless steel canisters as readily as paper bags. What would happen if you somehow came upon or created a dollop of universal acid? Would the whole planet eventually be destroyed? What would it leave in its wake? After everything had been transformed by its encounter with universal acid, what would the world look like? Little did I realize that in a few years I would encounter an idea, Darwin's idea, bearing an unmistakable likeness to universal acid. It eats through just about every traditional concept and leaves in its wake a revolutionized worldview, with most of the old landmarks still recognizable, but transformed in fundamental ways. Darwin's idea had been born as an answer to questions in biology, but it threatened to leak out, offering answers, welcome or not, to questions in cosmology, going in one direction, and psychology, going in the other direction. If redesign could be a mindless, algorithmic process of evolution, why couldn't that whole process itself be the product of evolution, and so forth, all the way down? And if mindless evolution could account for the breathtakingly clever artifacts of the biosphere, how could the products of our own real minds be exempt from an evolutionary explanation? Darwin's idea thus also threatened to spread all the way up, dissolving the illusion of our own authorship, our own divine spark of creativity and understanding. Much of the controversy and anxiety that has enveloped Darwin's idea ever since can be understood as a series of failed campaigns in the struggle to contain Darwin's idea within some acceptably safe and merely partial revolution. Cede some or all of modern biology to Darwin, perhaps, but hold the line there. Keep Darwinian thinking out of cosmology, out of psychology, out of human culture, out of ethics, politics, and religion. In these campaigns, many battles have been won by the forces of containment. Flawed applications of Darwin's idea have been exposed and discredited, beaten back by the champions of the pre-Darwinian tradition. But new waves of Darwinian thinking keep coming. They seem to be improved versions, not vulnerable to the refutations that defeated their predecessors. But are they sound extensions of the unquestionably sound Darwinian core idea, or might they too be perversions of it, and even more virulent, more dangerous than the abuses of Darwin already refuted? Opponents of the spread differ sharply over tactics. Just where should the protective dikes be built? Should we try to contain the idea within biology itself, with one post-Darwinian counter-revolution or another? Among those who have favored this tactic is Stephen Jay Gould, who has offered several different revolutions of containment. Or should we place the barriers farther out? To get our bearings in this series of campaigns, we should start with a crude map of the pre-Darwinian territory. As we shall hear, it will have to be revised again and again to make accommodations as various skirmishes are lost. 2. Darwin's assault on the cosmic pyramid. A prominent feature of pre-Darwinian worldviews is an overall top-to-bottom map of things. This is often described as a ladder. God is at the top, with human beings a rung or two below, depending on whether angels are part of the scheme. At the bottom of the ladder is nothingness, or maybe chaos, or maybe Locke's inert, motionless matter. Alternatively, the scale is a tower, or in the intellectual historian Arthur Lovejoy's memorable phrase in 1936, a great chain of being composed of many links. John Locke's argument has already drawn our attention to a particularly abstract version of the hierarchy, which I will call the cosmic pyramid. God, then below mind, then design, order, chaos, nothing. Warning, each term in the pyramid must be understood in an old-fashioned pre-Darwinian sense. Everything finds its place on one level or another of the cosmic pyramid, even blank nothingness, the ultimate foundation. Not all matter is ordered. Some is in chaos. Only some ordered matter is also designed. Only some designed things have minds. And, of course, only one mind is God. God, the first mind, is the source and explanation of everything underneath. Since everything thus depends on God, perhaps we should say it is a chandelier hanging from God rather than a pyramid supporting him. What is the difference between order and design? As a first stab, we might say that order is mere regularity, mere pattern. Design is Aristotle's telos, an exploitation of order for a purpose, such as we see in a cleverly designed artifact. The solar system exhibits stupendous order, but does not, apparently, have a purpose. It isn't for anything. An eye, in contrast, is for seeing. Before Darwin, this distinction was not always clearly marked. Indeed, it was positively blurred. In the 13th century, Aquinas offered the view that natural bodies, such as planets, raindrops, volcanoes, act as if guided toward a definite goal or end, so as to obtain the best result. This fitting of means to ends implies, argued Aquinas, an intention. But seeing as natural bodies lack consciousness, they cannot supply that intention themselves. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Davies, 1992, page 200. Hume's Cleanthes, following in this tradition, lumps the adapted marvels of the living world with the regularities of the heavens. It's all like a wonderful clockwork to him. But Darwin suggests a division. Give me order, he says, and time, and I will give you design. Let me start with regularity, the mere purposeless, mindless, pointless regularity of physics, and I will show you a process that eventually will yield products that exhibit not just regularity, but purposive design. This was just what Karl Marx thought he saw when he declared that Darwin had dealt a death blow to teleology. Darwin had reduced teleology to non-teleology, designed to order. Before Darwin, the difference between order and design didn't loom large, because in any case, it all came down from God. The whole universe was his artifact, a product of his intelligence, his mind. Once Darwin jumped into the middle with his proposed answer to the question of how design could arise from mere order, the rest of the cosmic pyramid was put in jeopardy. Suppose we accept that Darwin has explained the design of the bodies of plants and animals, including our own bodies. We have to admit that Darwin has placed us firmly in the animal kingdom. Looking up, if we concede to Darwin our bodies, can we keep him from taking our minds as well? We will address this question in many forms in Part 3. Looking down, Darwin asks us to give him order as a premise. But is there anything to keep him from stepping down a level and giving himself an algorithmic account of the origin of order out of mere chaos? We will address this question in Chapter 6. The vertigo and revulsion this prospect provokes in many was perfectly expressed in an early attack on Darwin, published anonymously in 1868. In the theory with which we have to deal, absolute ignorance is the artificer, so that we may enunciate as the fundamental principle of the whole system that, in order to make a perfect and beautiful machine, it is not requisite to know how to make it. This proposition will be found, on careful examination, to express in condensed form the essential purport of the theory, and to express in a few words all Mr. Darwin's meaning, who, by a strange inversion of reasoning, seems to think absolute ignorance fully qualified to take the place of absolute wisdom in all the achievements of creative skill. Mackenzie, 1868. Exactly. Darwin's strange inversion of reasoning was, in fact, a new and wonderful way of thinking, completely overturning the mind-first way that John Locke proved and David Hume could see no way around. John Dewey nicely described the inversion some years later in his insightful book, The Influence of Darwin on Philosophy. Interest shifts. From an intelligence that shaped things once for all to the particular intelligences which things are even now shaping. Dewey, 1910, page 15. But the idea of treating mind as an effect rather than as a first cause is too revolutionary for some, an awful stretcher that their own minds cannot accommodate comfortably. This is as true today as it was in 1860. And it has always been as true of some of evolution's best friends as of its foes. For instance, the physicist Paul Davies, in his recent book, The Mind of God, proclaims that the reflective power of human minds can be no trivial detail, no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces. Davies, 1992, page 232. This is a most revealing way of expressing a familiar denial, for it betrays an ill-examined prejudice. Why, we might ask Davies, would its being a byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces make it trivial? Why couldn't the most important thing of all be something that arose from unimportant things? Why should the importance or excellence of anything have to rain down on it from on high? From something more important, a gift from God. Darwin's inversion suggests that we abandon that presumption and look for sorts of excellence, of worth and purpose that can emerge, bubbling up out of mindless, purposeless forces. Alfred Russel Wallace, whose own version of evolution by natural selection arrived on Darwin's desk while he was still delaying publication of Origin, and whom Darwin managed to treat as co-discoverer of the principle, never quite got the point. Although at the outset Wallace was much more forthcoming on the subject of the evolution of the human mind than Darwin was willing to be, and stoutly maintained at first that human minds were no exception to the rule that all features of living things were products of evolution, he could not see the strange inversion of reasoning as the key to the greatness of the great idea. Echoing John Locke, Wallace proclaimed that the marvelous complexity of forces which appear to control matter, if not actually to constitute it, are and must be mind products. Gould, 1985, page 397. When, later in his life, Wallace converted to spiritualism and exempted human consciousness altogether from the iron rule of evolution, Darwin saw the crack widen and wrote to him, "I hope you have not murdered too completely your own and my child." Desmond and Moore, 1991, page 569. But was it really so inevitable that Darwin's idea should lead to such revolution and subversion? It is obvious that the critics did not wish to understand, and to some extent Darwin himself encouraged their wishful thinking. Elligard, 1956. Wallace wanted to ask what the purpose of natural selection might be. And though this might seem, in retrospect, to be squandering the fortune he and Darwin had uncovered, it was an idea for which Darwin himself often expressed sympathy. Instead of reducing teleology all the way to purposeless order, why couldn't we reduce all mundane teleology to a single purpose? God's purpose. Wasn't this an obvious and inviting way to plug the dike? Darwin was clear in his own mind that the variation on which the process of natural selection depended had to be unplanned and undesigned, but the process itself might have a purpose, mightn't it? In a letter in 1860 to the American naturalist Asa Gray, an early supporter, Darwin wrote, "I am inclined to look at everything as resulting from designed laws, with the details, whether good or bad, left to the working out of what we may call chance." F. Darwin, 1911, Volume 2, page 105. Automatic processes are themselves often creations of great brilliance. From today's vantage point, we can see that the inventors of the automatic transmission and the automatic door opener were no idiots, and their genius lay in seeing how to create something that could do something clever without having to think about it. Indulging in some anachronism, we could say that, to some observers in Darwin's day, it seemed that he had left open the possibility that God did his handiwork by designing an automatic design maker. And to some of these, the idea was not just a desperate stopgap, but a positive improvement on tradition. The first chapter of Genesis describes the successive waves of creation and ends each with the refrain, "And God saw that it was good." Darwin had discovered a way to eliminate this retail application of intelligent quality control. Natural selection would take care of that without further intervention from God. The 17th century philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz had defended a similar hands-off vision of God the Creator. As Henry Ward Beecher put it, "Design by wholesale is grander than design by retail." Rachel's, 1991, page 99. Asa Gray, captivated by Darwin's new idea but trying to reconcile it with as much of his traditional religious creed as possible, came up with this marriage of convenience. God intended the stream of variations and foresaw just how the laws of nature he had laid down would prune this stream over the eons. As John Dewey later aptly remarked, invoking yet another mercantile metaphor, Gray held to what may be called design on the installment plan. Dewey, 1910, page 12. It is not unusual to find such metaphors, redolent of capitalism, in evolutionary explanations. Examples are often gleefully recounted by those critics and interpreters of Darwin who see this language as revealing, or should we say betraying, the social and political environment in which Darwin developed his ideas, thereby somehow discrediting their claim to scientific objectivity. It is certainly true that Darwin, being an ordinary mortal, was the inheritor of a huge manifold of concepts, modes of expression, attitudes, biases, and visions that went with his station in life, as a Victorian Englishman might put it. But it is also true that the economic metaphors that come so naturally to mind when one is thinking about evolution get their power from one of the deepest features of Darwin's discovery. 3. The principle of the accumulation of design. The key to understanding Darwin's contribution is granting the premise of the argument from design. What conclusion ought one to draw if one found a watch lying on the heath in the wilderness? As Paley and Hume's Cleanthes before him insisted, a watch exhibits a tremendous amount of work done. Watches and other designed objects don't just happen. They have to be the product of what modern industry calls R&D, research and development. And R&D is costly, in both time and energy. Before Darwin, the only model we had of a process by which this sort of R&D work could be done was an intelligent artificer. What Darwin saw was that, in principle, the same work could be done by a different sort of process that distributed that work over huge amounts of time. By thriftily conserving the design work that had been accomplished at each stage, so that it didn't have to be done over again. In other words, Darwin had hit upon what we might call the principle of accumulation of design. Things in the world, such as watches and organisms and who knows what else, may be seen as products embodying a certain amount of design, and one way or another, that design had to have been created by a process of R&D, utter undesignedness. Pure chaos in the old-fashioned sense was the null or starting point. A more recent idea about the difference and tight relation between design and order will help clarify the picture. This is the proposal, first popularized by the physicist Erwin Schrödinger in 1967, that life can be defined in terms of the second law of thermodynamics. In physics, order or organization can be measured in terms of heat differences between regions of spacetime. Entropy is simply disorder, the opposite of order, and according to the second law, the entropy of any isolated system increases with time. In other words, things run down inevitably. According to the second law, the universe is unwinding out of a more ordered state into the ultimately disordered state known as the heat death of the universe. What then are living things? They are things that defy this crumbling into dust, at least for a while, by not being isolated, by taking in from their environment the wherewithal to keep life and limb together. The psychologist Richard Gregory summarizes the idea crisply. Time's arrow given by entropy, the loss of organization or loss of temperature differences, is statistical, and it is subject to local, small-scale reversals. Most striking, life is a systematic reversal of entropy, and intelligence creates structures and energy differences against the supposed gradual death through entropy of the physical universe. Gregory, 1981, page 136. Gregory goes on to credit Darwin with the fundamental enabling idea. It is the measure of the concept of natural selection that increases in the complexity and order of organisms in biological time can now be understood. Not just individual organisms, but the whole process of evolution that creates them, thus can be seen as fundamental physical phenomena running contrary to the larger trend of cosmic time, a feature captured by William Calvin in one of the meanings of the title of his classic exploration of the relationship between evolution and cosmology, The River That Flows Uphill, A Journey from the Big Bang to the Big Brain, 1986. A designed thing, then, is either a living thing or part of a living thing, or the artifact of a living thing, organized in any case in aid of this battle against disorder. It is not impossible to oppose the trend of the second law, but it is costly. Consider iron. Iron is a very useful element, essential for our bodily health, and also valuable as the major component of steel, that wonderful building material. Our planet used to have vast reserves of iron ore, but they are gradually being depleted. Does this mean that the Earth is running out of iron? Hardly. With the trivial exception of a few tons that have recently been launched out of Earth's effective gravitational field in the form of space probe components, there is just as much iron on the planet today as there ever was. The trouble is that more and more of it is scattered about in the form of rust, molecules of iron oxide, and other low-grade, low-concentration materials. In principle, it could all be recovered, but that would take enormous amounts of energy, craftily focused on the particular project of extracting and reconcentrating the iron. It is the organization of just such sophisticated processes that constitutes the hallmark of life. Gregory dramatizes this with an unforgettable example. A standard textbook expression of the directionality imposed by the second law of thermodynamics is the claim that you can't unscramble an egg. Well, not that you absolutely can't, but that it would be an extremely costly, sophisticated task, uphill all the way against the second law. Now consider, how expensive would it be to make a device that would take scrambled eggs as input and deliver unscrambled eggs as output? There is one ready solution. Put a live hen in the box. Feed it scrambled eggs, and it will be able to make eggs for you, for a while. Hens don't normally strike us as near miraculously sophisticated entities, but here is one thing a hen can do, thanks to the design that has organized it, that is still way beyond the reach of the devices created by human engineers. The more design a thing exhibits, the more R&D work had to have occurred to produce it. Like any good revolutionary, Darwin exploits as much as possible of the old system. The vertical dimension of the cosmic pyramid is retained and becomes the measure of how much design has gone into the items at that level. In Darwin's scheme, as in the traditional pyramid, minds do end up near the top, among the most designed of entities, in part because they are the self-redesigning things, as we shall discuss in Chapter 13. But this means that they are among the most advanced effects to date of the creative process, not, as in the old version, its cause or source. Their products in turn, the human artifacts that were our initial model, must count as more designed still. This may seem counterintuitive at first. A Keats ode may seem to have some claim to having a grander R&D pedigree than a nightingale. At least it might seem so to a poet ignorant of biology. But what about a paperclip? Surely a paperclip is a trivial product of design compared with any living thing, however rudimentary. In one obvious sense, yes. But reflect for a moment. Put yourself in Paley's shoes, but walking along the apparently deserted beach on an alien planet. Which discovery would excite you the most? A clam or a clam rake? Before the planet could make a clam rake, it would have to make a clam rake maker, and that is a more designed thing by far than a clam. Only a theory with the logical shape of Darwin's could explain how designed things came to exist, because any other sort of explanation would be either a vicious circle or an infinite regress. Dennett, 1975. The old way, Locke's mind-first way, endorsed the principle that it takes an intelligence to make an intelligence. This idea must have always seemed self-evident to our ancestors, the artifact makers, going back to Homo habilis, the handyman from whom Homo sapiens, the knowing man, descended. Nobody ever saw a spear fashion a hunter out of raw materials. Children chant, "It takes one to know one." But an even more persuasive slogan would seem to be, "It takes a greater one to make a lesser one." Any view inspired by this slogan immediately faces an embarrassing question, however. As Hume had noted, if God created and designed all these wonderful things, who created God? Super God? And who created Super God? Super Duper God? Or did God create himself? Was it hard work? Did it take time? Don't ask! Well, then we may ask instead whether this bland embrace of mystery is any improvement over just denying the principle that intelligence, or design, must spring from intelligence. Darwin offered an explanatory path that actually honored Paley's insight. Real work went into designing this watch, and work isn't free. How much design does a thing exhibit? No one has yet offered a system of design quantification that meets all our needs. Theoretical work that bears on this interesting question is underway in several disciplines. And in Chapter 6, we will consider a natural metric that provides a neat solution to special cases. But in the meantime, we have a powerful, intuitive sense of different amounts of design. Automobiles contain more design than bicycles. Sharks contain more design than amoebas. And even a short poem contains more design than a "keep off the grass" sign. I can hear the skeptical listener saying, "Whoa, slow down. Is this supposed to be uncontroversial?" Not by a long shot. In due course, I will attempt to justify these claims. But for the time being, I want to draw attention to and build on some familiar, but admittedly unreliable, intuitions. Patent law, including the law of copyright, is a repository of our practical grasp of the question, how much novelty of design counts as enough to justify a patent? How much can one borrow from the intellectual products of others without recompense or acknowledgement? These are slippery slopes on which we have had to construct some rather arbitrary terraces, codifying what otherwise would be a matter of interminable dispute. The burden of proof in these disputes is fixed by our intuitive sense of how much design is too much design to be mere coincidence. Our intuitions here are very strong and, I promise to demonstrate, sound. Suppose an author is accused of plagiarism, and the evidence is, say, a single paragraph that is almost identical to a paragraph in the putative source. Might this be just a coincidence? It depends crucially on how mundane and formulaic the paragraph is, but most paragraph-length passages of texts are special enough, in ways we will soon explore, to make independent creation highly unlikely. No reasonable jury would require the prosecutor in a plagiarism case to demonstrate exactly the causal pathway by which the alleged copying took place. The defendant would clearly have the burden of establishing that his work was, remarkably, an independent work rather than a copying of work already done. A similar burden of proof falls on the defendant in an industrial espionage case. The interior of the defendant's new line of widgets looks suspiciously similar in design to that of the plaintiff's line of widgets. Is this an innocent case of convergent evolution of design? Really, the only way to prove your innocence in such a case is to show clear evidence of actually having done the necessary R&D work, old blueprints, rough drafts, early models and mock-ups, memos about the problems encountered, etc. In the absence of such evidence, but also in the absence of any physical evidence of your espionage activities, you would be convicted, and you deserve to be. Cosmic coincidences on such a scale just don't happen. The same burden of proof now reigns in biology, thanks to Darwin. What I am calling the principle of accumulation of design doesn't logically require that all design on this planet descend via one branch or another from a single trunk or root or seed, but it says that since each new designed thing that appears must have a large design investment in its etiology somewhere, the cheapest hypothesis will always be that the design is largely copied from earlier designs, which are copied from earlier designs, and so forth, so that actual R&D innovation is minimized. We know for a fact, of course, that many designs have been independently reinvented many times. Eyes, for instance, dozens of times. But every case of such convergent evolution must be proven against a background in which most of the design is copied. It is logically possible that all the life forms in South America were created independently of all the life forms in the rest of the world. But this is a wildly extravagant hypothesis that would need to be demonstrated piece by piece. Suppose we discover on some remote island a novel species of bird. Even if we don't yet have direct, confirmatory evidence that this bird is related to all the other birds in the world, that is our overpoweringly secure default assumption, after Darwin, because birds are very special designs. So the fact that organisms, and computers, and books, and other artifacts, are effects of very special chains of causation is not, after Darwin, a merely reliable generalization, but a deep fact out of which to build a theory. Hume recognized the point. Throw several pieces of steel together without shape or form. They will never arrange themselves to compose a watch. But he and other earlier thinkers thought they had to ground this deep fact in mind. Darwin came to see how to distribute it in vast spaces of non-mind, thanks to his ideas about how design innovations could be conserved and reproduced, and hence accumulated. The idea that design is something that has taken work to create, and hence has value, at least in the sense that it is something that might be conserved and then stolen or sold, finds robust expression in economic terms. Had Darwin not had the benefit of being born